Hello and welcome to the last in our special series of podcast episodes for Worming Week in partnership with Agria. So far this week, we've explored the different parasite tests available and why using a test-led approach is so important. But it would be really amiss to not also touch on the environmental impact of the drugs that are used to treat parasites, because it is a really important topic. Joining me to discuss this, first up, we've got Claire Shand, who has previously actually talked about worming with us in a previous Equine Health Week campaign. Claire is director at Westgate Labs, which specialises in parasite control for horses, and she was voted Equine SQP of the Year in 2023. Claire sits on the core steering group for CANTA, a collaborative industry-led organisation dedicated to tackling anthelmintic resistance. And you'll have heard that organisation come up plenty of times this week. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you so much. What a lovely intro.
And joining us as well is Ruth Dancer, who is director of White Griffin, where she supports the sport and culture industries, including British Equestrian, with transitioning to a sustainable future. A chartered environmentalist, Ruth has previously worked in sport for 18 years at big events, including London 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games and the England Rugby World Cup 2015. Welcome, Ruth.
Thank you so much. I hate the 18 years part, though. I instantly feel very old.
Sorry to shame you this early in the podcast.
I know, come on.
So probably the place to start actually with this is, I mentioned it in the intro, but what are anthelmintics and why do we need to be so careful about their use when it comes to the environment?
Yeah, it's a strange term, isn't it? I think it's because parasitic worms are also known as helminths. So then you get the anti and then the like treatment x on the end. So then they become anthelmintics, and we know them as wormers or dewormers. So it's the straightforward name. And they're the prescription medicines that we give our animals in order to treat them for internal parasites. So lots of brand names, but actually we only have five chemicals with the active ingredients that are licensed in horses. So that's fenbendazole, pyrantel, ivermectin, moxidectin and praziquantel. And you'll probably be familiar with those if you look on the back of the wormer packages that you get.
Why is it so important that we are considering when we use them? Obviously, up to now in the podcast, we've talked about why it's important sort of for your horse and why a testing-led approach is so important. But in the event that you are having to use one of these five drugs, why is it important that we are being very careful about doing that in terms of thinking about the environment?
Yeah, so concern of the overuse of worming chemicals is twofold. You'll have already talked about the rapid resistance problems and how to approach worming that way. But also this new area of research is revealing these devastating effects they can wreak on the environment as well. And that's what we really want to take a deep dive on today.
And how can they get into the environment then? If you've put the wormer tube in your horse's mouth, how does it go from that?
Yeah, so the worm is either by syringe or liquid in the feed that's going into the horse's gut. And when it's there, not all of that is absorbed by the horse. That means it's going straight through the system and then being excreted in the dung. And then it's doing the same job out in the environment as it's designed to do inside our horse. And just for a little bit of context, I was totally shocked to hear this, that when you put a dose of ivermectin, which is one of our most commonly used wormers for horses, into the horse, it's estimated that between 80 to 98% of that goes absolutely straight through the horse and then is excreted, lands in the dung pile without being metabolized or changed in any way by the horse's body. And like, that's just phenomenal because of the impact that it has once it lands there. You know, they are toxic in the environment. And the other thing that we really need to look at then is the fecal excretion time. So they all take slightly different times to go through that process, depending on the chemical and how that works in the body. So, yeah, we talked then about ivermectin. It's one of our worst offenders because it and moxidectin, they're linked chemicals. So they're from a chemical group called the macrocyclic lactones, and they will have peak excretion sort of ivermectin 2.5 days after administration. But then within four days later, that's still coming out in dung, or for moxidectin, that's still coming 8 days. That's still coming out in the horse's feces. So it's important how we manage those horses, just being aware that then they are sort of walking ecotoxicity time bombs going off in our paddocks, really, I guess, is how you might look at it. And so, yeah, it's really important to look at that, what they're shedding in the environment, and then how we manage that, because they're also, they persist. So they know, like, a dung pat sits in a field from a horse that's had ivermectin, and 45 days later, there's still ivermectin. You can monitor that medication, that chemical is still there. So yeah, they've got these really big impacts. Ivermectin and moxidectin being the most toxic. And then I think it goes down, put it somewhere here. Oh yeah. Then fenbendazole, praziquantel, and pyrantel, sort of like a decreasing toxicity. And that's not saying that we must never use those treatments. It's always the balance of choosing like the most appropriate treatment for the horse, being aware of their impact in the, on the environment. Like, how can we then modify that and manage that? But it can be better to give one appropriate dose than having to go in with a worm that's not quite so effective and having to do it multiple times. So we're just always balancing those pieces of what's right for the horse, and then just knowing what we're doing in the environment as well.
And then once that, as I say, once that horse poo is in your field, and it is this, as you said, ticking time bomb.
Yeah.
What actually is it doing? What are the effects of, I guess, sort of within your horse's paddock, that those that ticking time bomb is going to have?
Yeah, so that, well, I guess the first most immediate impact is on our dung beetles. You know, we love a dung beetle. Ruthie, you must love a dung beetle.
Oh, well, now I don't have favourites when it comes to the natural environment. I love all of my invertebrates and beetles equally.
But in this particular podcast, we're favouring the dung beetle.
Well, I'll go a dung beetle, sure. I remember I was filming last year on them. It was a stud, and we were desperately looking for some manure with a dung beetle in to film at the time. And I am still to this day kind of horrified and amused in equal measure by the squeal of excitement that came out of my mouth when I did actually find one for the cameraman. I don't think anyone has ever looked so excited and happy whilst scraping through poo. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. So sure, up the dung beetles.
Yeah, and they're just in massive decline. And that is in large part to the wormers that we're using in our grazing animals, because they're first on the scene, they are most affected by contaminated dung, and then they get lethal doses, or it affects their reproduction, which obviously then stops their life cycle. So that's really massive. And these guys play a really important role in grassland ecology. You know, they really are nature's dustbin men. So they can actually do some of our hard work for us. How many hours do we all spend poo picking? And they could actually, if we could look after them and encourage them, they could really, really help, not just with improving our paddocks and our grassland management, but also in, they have a by what they do. We have tunnelers and dwellers in the UK. We don't have any rollers, you know, those iconic kind of African images, but they're still doing fantastic things for us and helping to break the life cycle of the parasites. And they're doing that naturally without us having to go out and do lots of poo picking or give the chemicals to our horses. So they're really amazing, and doing things like aerating soil, improving the organic matter, helping the soil absorb water, which reduces the runoff, which you'll be really passionate about, Ruth, is something that soil erosion.
Yeah, and I think actually I just want to come back to a key point of what you mentioned a moment ago, which is the fact that it's absolutely right that we use drugs on ourselves and our animals to solve really, really important problems. But we do need to make sure that everyone is properly aware that those drugs are almost as powerful and potent when they're coming out in dung. And if they're so good at killing off the nasties in our horse's gut, or indeed when it comes to our own challenges with pharmaceuticals, anything that we want to fix in our bodies, they have the same ability to kill off what's in the natural environment. It's the same. What's in the horse's gut and what's in the field are both getting killed off at almost the same levels. And I think that the worry is to what extent we recognize and value the creatures that are living in those spaces. So either in that immediate sense, exactly as Claire's talking about, in the dung and in the surrounding soil, And then as Claire was just going on to talk about with water runoff and the impact that these pharmaceuticals have when they then enter our waterways. And both of those situations are genuinely at crisis point at this point. And it's just really important for people to start to almost visualize, almost cutting out the middleman. Imagine you weren't putting it in the horse at all. Would you spray or treat the wildlife in the land or in the water with something that you know will kill the vital parts of the ecosystem, i.e. that bottom part of the pyramid? As Claire mentioned, it can be dung beetles, but actually any invertebrates, any of those tiny creatures that sit right at the bottom and do all of the hard work and maintain the number one most important thing on earth for us, which is soil. Would you be happy to just throw a load of chemicals or pharmaceuticals in that space, knowing that that's what's going to happen? And I think when we break it down to almost a very simple visual like that, it enables us to be more considered and cautious and careful in the choices and the way that we A, treat our animals, and B, manage the manure during that treatment process.
Yeah, it's such a good point. We're all countryside lovers and nature lovers, and yet you only have to turn on a nature program to hear the massive decline. And you're absolutely right about that food chain, and that it goes all the way up if you break it at that bottom point. And it's not just the dung beetles, you know, it's the worms, it's the other invertebrates. But also, I was really interested to learn that it is absorbed by plants as well. Like, it can reduce the grass germination by 30%. And then from a forage and a soil erosion perspective, that's really bad in our horse paddocks. You know, it's what our horses eat. And then, you know, mud. We're in January. We're all, I'm sure, as horse owners, keepers, struggling with that one.
Yeah, exactly. We're at the point where any bit of grass is good at the moment. So the more we can do to keep the grass in the fields and not just have the horses on a swamp of mudland, which is what certain areas of my fields are looking like at the moment, as I'm sure many people can sympathise. Absolutely the better.
And it will. And I think that this, you know, and this is almost a little bit of a sidebar to this podcast, but I think it's a really useful moment to bring up the importance of soil, because I think soil is so misunderstood or just not understood at all. I think I heard someone say we know more about the universe than we do about the soil. And although there are some incredible organizations out there like the Soil Association, etc., who have very knowledgeable scientists, and there are of course a huge number of people working in the nature and scientific and conservation community that know a great deal about soil, the average person probably knows almost nothing. And this does matter, because when we talk about the environment and when we talk about sustainability, we have this awful tendency to make it very unrelatable. You know, it's often someone else's problem, or something I do is so small it doesn't really matter, or it's so scientific I don't really get it, so I'll carry on doing it anyway. You know, there are all these stumbling blocks. And so I think, you know, taking this particular podcast as an opportunity to just really draw people's attention to how incredibly important our soil is. And it's a fundamental part of horse ownership, because exactly as Claire says, without healthy soil, we do not have healthy grass for our horses. And there's a really big reason why the top horse owners, trainers, breeders, etc., pay a huge amount of money for specialists in soil management, because they know that good quality grass equals really good quality high value horses. And of course, from a welfare point of view, we want them to have good quality pasture as well. So we need to start switching the narrative in our equestrian community to loving our soil and really understanding what that means. And a part of that is most definitely about this worming and pharmaceutical control and management, because it is all part of the same picture. And having rich, healthy soil is fundamental in a number of key ways. Number one, a lot of people don't realize that it's a substantial carbon sink. So we are obviously considerably concerned about climate change. We often talk about trees. We never talk about soil and grassland. Soil and grassland is our most resilient, robust, and significant form of carbon storage. So as horse owners, looking after our soil and grassland should be our number one priority for our horse and for the environment. And so thinking about what we're doing with our worming drugs definitely plays into that narrative. Really important. The second one is really rich organic matter means that we have boosts fertility ultimately, and which means our grass grows more quickly. So again, when we're thinking about that resilience and, you know, being a good horse owner and not trudging through boggy mud, looking after our soil and not killing it off and not damaging it with pharmaceuticals, etc., would be another area. Water retention. So right now I'm sat in my office in deepest, darkest Gloucestershire, and it is throwing it down. It's absolutely throwing it down, which is good because we've had such a dry period this last, almost 24 months now. But that does mean a lot of people start to struggle with waterlogged and unusable paddocks. If you take care of your soil in particular, then it can better absorb water. And there's some really simple tests you can do at home. I know that this isn't what this podcast's about, but just simple measurements to see how well your soil can drain helps you with creating that better environment for your horse. And of course, we talked about soil biodiversity in terms of everything that's living in there, but also just that resilience against drought, erosion. So for every reason possible, good quality soil should be our number one priority. And in the broadest sense as a human being, we totally depend on it for our food. Our food system is dependent on us not destroying our soil. And there are so many terrifying statistics out there about how many harvests we've essentially got left. So I just think that this is a really important moment in this podcast to reference that, because when do I ever get a chance to talk about soil otherwise? And equally, you know, when we think about those worming drugs getting into the soil and you know, causing, well, A, deaths, but also just actually other challenges in nature. So to do with hormones, to do with growth, to do with behavior change. Scientists have discovered that actually any number of these pharmaceuticals getting into our ecosystem creates all sorts of chaos and knock-on effects to the animals on which we fundamentally depend. And so it comes down to not taking that ecosystem for granted and recognizing that we've got to stop, in Claire's words, you know, just spreading mini bombs all over the place and thinking it will be all right, because it won't be.
There we go. Very powerful statement there. But no, I love it. That was very good. And this is probably the point then to say we've talked about there a lot of the problems of using these drugs. And obviously the first point here to reduce that is to lead with the test-led approach that we have spent this week discussing and why that's important. But there are going to be scenarios where we do have to put these drugs into our horses. If that is the case, what steps can we take to reduce the impact on our environment?
Yeah, so absolutely. When we do need to use them, we mustn't hold back on that. And so first of all, doing our testing and just treating the horses that actually need it is going to go a long way to helping that. It's going to, Wormec counts can reduce our need for treatment by 80%, tapeworm testing by 70%. And we've got new tests coming on board all the time, like the small redworm blood test and our larval culturing for large redworm, which again is going to really help us pinpoint which horses need it. Only giving the chemicals to those particular horses and leaving the rest untreated. So that in its own right is going to leave dung that's kind of clean, you know, it's uncontaminated, that's going to leave habitat. So that's fantastic. Also then doing our poo picking, again, it's going to help. And if we can do our poo picking in a way that supports dung beetle populations, so perhaps changing our mindset to leave the freshest, sort of, they love the first 24, 48 hours of dung piles, and we can clean them after that, which will be before any worm eggs hatch, and therefore we'll be able to still prevent those hatching larvae of the worms from getting onto our pasture and infecting it. But if we leave some habitat, we can start to try and build those populations back. And we have research that shows that a dung beetle will fly in 10 miles to the right dung And they just are so tuned into that. And so it might take some time, especially if you're located in a place where it's quite arable and there's not many other like farms with cattle, sheep, whatever, or horses around you. But with time and dedication, it will change, and we can all get very excited when we're poo picking and we see that busy dung piles with dung, you know, with the dung beetles being active. And you can see on your pasture as well the effect of those, because you can see how they desiccate the dung and it basically deal with it. They're pulling it into the soil, they're eating it, they're dwelling in it, and nature's doing its thing. So that's kind of a real good approach. But then once we have given the treatment, it's going back to those peak excretion times. So if you can stable, if only for the peak excretion time, because I know you talk to any horse owner and they have real angst about keeping horses in stables for long periods. You know, it's not what they're naturally designed to do. And particularly horses that are kept at grass that we suddenly hoik in, there can be a distress, like a behavioural element to that. But if you can't keep them in, even for that peak excretion, which is... we're looking kind of like 24 to 48 hours after giving the wormer, not putting it, worming them and then putting them straight into a stable, but waiting for that wormer to have gone through the system until that's being excreted, or at least putting them into a small paddock, poo picking religiously, so that then you're lifting that chemically contaminated dung off the pasture. And then we can put it in a special muck heap. So we've got research that shows that even though ivermectin is very resilient in the environment, if you can compost that thermophilically, so that's when the center gets over 60 degrees, that will break that down and it denatures it. So it makes it non-effective in doing the killing and the other toxic elements, which is brilliant. So, and it means that then once you've left it, you could spread it back onto the land if you wanted to. It basically makes it inert, and leaving that at least 6 months so that any worm eggs there hopefully are going to die off as well, and you're not going to reinfect your pasture with that, because we're all after kind of natural and fertilization, but let's do it in the right way that's not going to bring a parasite challenge along the way, or kind of helping with these chemicals as well. And then giving the wormers when the dung beetles are less active, so November to February, if you can, is something else to think about, really, because dung beetles, they like a muck heap, but they're not, they're attracted to them, but they don't actually breed in them. So there's that element just to consider. And we've also got, from a parasite control perspective, managing the horses after worming, again, particularly if you're worming for tapeworm, you can, being able to do the poo picking or keep them in helps, because the tapeworms are shed in packets. So as you kill off the tapeworms, these packets are shed into the dung and then they burst and they release a lot of eggs in one go onto the pasture. So again, if you are doing that work to remove them, it stops that reinfection going onto the pasture as well. So you're going to again minimize reinfection. Well, tapeworm have a little orobated grassland mite that is their intermediate host, so that's what eats the eggs first of all, and that's what's running around that our horses are ingesting. So yeah, but they can, there are other things for them to eat instead. We're not going to deprive them, and again, very important for ecosystem development too.
There's so many great tips in there, Claire, and I particularly wanted to kind of pull out when you were talking there about essentially composting and the mechanism for removing the risk so that we can put that amazing nutrition from the poo back into the land, which is so important. And I just wanted to maybe take the opportunity to highlight, in addition to the opportunity to use drugs like ivermectin or any of the others, you know, let's not forget that there are other nature-based solutions, in the same way that composting is Mother Nature's way of putting all the nutrients back into the land. Thinking about the grasses that we put into our paddock in the first place can also be another option. It's not not an instead of, or don't, you know, use drugs. I'm definitely not saying that. But there are natural worm dewormers in the environment, like Samphan, for example, is a really good grass for that. It's also really, really good grass for resilience in your paddock. It's incredibly long rooted, probably the longest root of all the different grasses. And that essentially means that it can do fantastic work in the soil under the ground. And it's really good at storing, again, that carbon that we talked about in terms of different options for combating climate change. So I think it's worth remembering that there are lots of different solutions out there, and it's always good to look to Mother Nature and how she wants us to look after the soil, because, you know, she's done a pretty good job for millions of years of creating a healthy ecosystem. So it's always good to check her directory as well.
It's brilliant.
We came in and meddled.
Well, I'm not saying that, but yes, it's always good to remind ourselves what might a nature-based solution look like. And as I say, that's not to, you know, it's definitely not to say don't use drugs. We all reach for aspirins and things. I'm not saying that that's a, you know, we mustn't do that. But let's not forget there are some alternatives as well that you could keep in your toolkit and try to see if they work.
Yeah, and it is worth remembering that the reason we have these parasite challenges come from how we keep our horses. So, like, you know, a long time ago when horses roamed, the reason that the worms themselves evolved to kick out so many millions of eggs a day is because horses wouldn't stay in one place. They would dung and then they would move, and they traveled so many miles. And also there could have been a sheep or a goat or a woolly mammoth come along and be grazing that grass with the worm larvae on it. And of course they're species specific, so if one of those other species ate a worm larvae that was destined for a horse, that would be toast. And so there were so many failures in the whole like life cycle of that worm, and yet now we keep the horses usually single species. They graze back over the same land, and that's why we've got these massive challenges, is because it's not how evolution made it to be. Do you know, we're playing into the hands of the parasites essentially, so we've got to then think clever about ways that we can get around that.
It's such a good point, and I think that it's also a very, you know, human beings are so amazing at so many things, but I do think we have a bit of a toxic trait of finding a problem to solve a problem, the way that we've consistently done things over the last few decades has essentially got us to where we are now. And so all of the tips that Claire's just given are just a different way of thinking and just a different way of approaching a problem. And I do feel that what's going to give us a happy and healthy future is recognizing that how we've always done things has got us into difficulty, but we do have alternatives. And the alternative isn't stop everything, don't do anything, live a miserable life, get rid of all our horses, go back to living in a mud hut. And the alternative is just factoring in, am I doing harm? What does that harm look like? How can I minimize that harm? And taking that one moment and then using the advice of experts like Claire and resources online just to tweak things slightly, you know, because, again, we've talked a lot about soil and the impact there. But the fact of the matter is that, again, when we use a problem to try and fix a solution, what we do is just expand the size of the problem. So we've now gone from creating a problem in our field to creating a problem with our soil, which means that we're now getting water runoff because we don't have that resilience in our paddocks to be able to drain the water effectively and to grow good, healthy soil. And so now we've got the issue where we've got runoff from our fields. We know that we have that in agriculture, but we have that on our equestrian farms too. And every single one of our waters in the UK is polluted. The UK is has the most polluted rivers in Europe. And over 40% of that is pharmaceuticals. Now, I'm clearly not saying that 40% of that is from worming drugs from horse owners. Of course I'm not. You know, there are lots and lots and lots of factors. But we're part of it. And we want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So when we think about the health of our waterways and how incredibly concerned we've become in the last, you know, 18 months or so about the pollution that gets poured into it by, you know, water authorities, and that's made an awful lot of headlines. We've got an awful lot of plastic pollution. We need to remember that the kind of invisible silent problem is the pharmaceuticals, and it's the pharmaceuticals that are fundamentally changing the nature of the animals, or, you know, water life that's living in our rivers and our waterways. So we're spreading out our problem that originated in, you know, had it like the one over my shoulder. with an absolutely stunning rainbow. I realise this is a podcast, but there's an incredible rainbow that's just appeared over my shoulder. How beautiful. And, you know, so we're no longer confining our problem to our paddock. As Claire says, you know, we've tried to fix a problem with another problem. Now that problem is now trickling out into our waterways. And all of a sudden we've got issues with our land animals and issues in our waterways too. So we need to just stop all of that. Do all of the things that Claire has suggested, and maybe also considering what I've suggested around nature-based solutions as well. And then we can start to build nature back.
So that's really stark, Ruth. I hadn't realised the stats around pharmaceuticals and in actual our waterways. And maybe it's a good time to start to talk about positioning of muck heaps, because it's rainwater runoff that leaches through that can contribute to that as well, isn't it?
It is, and it's why we've got such strict legislation in this country around, you know, where and how we maintain our muck heaps. And, you know, there is very little legislation in some ways around maintaining a horse. I don't know if some horse owners may disagree with me there, but, you know, realistically speaking, you know, I can go out and own a horse tomorrow, and I don't have to have any qualifications to do so. But the impact, certainly for a long time, we've known that we have to be really careful in this particular area. And there's very clear legislation, both in terms of for individual horse owners and businesses, and even on events for temporary stables, you know, not locating it close to a water course. And this is why it's a genuine, real problem. And, you know, to take it that next step further. Yes, I'm concerned about, of course, the health of those rivers and that water and what's going on with those animals and plants and what that means in that broader sense. But, you know, we have to remember that ultimately it's a water cycle, and it's a cycle for a reason. And that water ends up coming back into us as human beings. And there is a much bigger conversation around toxins in our environment in a general sense, and the absolute profusion and the way in which that gets back into our food system and our water supply, and how that impacts our own personal health. You know, we quite rightly talk all the time about horse welfare, as we should. But this is an area, again, where what we're doing to help the horse, it's all connected. And ultimately, you know, the fact that we have these highly polluted, hugely toxic rivers, you know, let's face it, I went to Iceland some time ago, and I was kneeling down, you know, I was on my belly drinking straight out of one of the streams. Would you do that in the UK? No.
No.
For the listeners at home, both ladies are shaking their head. And, you know, and it's sad. It's sad because we have a beautiful country with beautiful wildlife and stunning scenery. And why shouldn't we have crystal clear waters? Why have we accepted the state of our soil and the state of our waterways? Why have we said that that's okay? It's not okay. It would be wonderful to be able to just paddle around and enjoy the water without thinking about all the nasties that are in it. And we absolutely can if we change our behaviours. And actually, when we do that, nature comes back really quickly. You know, nature is a resilient old lady, and she, if we treat her right, she fixes and repairs quite fast. But we've abused the land and the waterways for so long that we are all collectively going to need to make those changes, all of us together, all whatever it is, however many millions of horse riders and owners.
Mm-hmm. So don't put your muck heap within 10 meters of a water course. Cover it with a tarp. Yep. If you can, to reduce the risk of runoff. And from a parasite control perspective, position it at least 3 meters outside of fields, just to prevent any hatching larvae from recontaminating and the need to use more chemicals. So yeah, some really good tips we could all be doing in order, as you say, Ruth, just, you know, to get back to where we need to be for our health, for our watercourses.
Yeah, and I think that's something that has been quite evident in this podcast, is we're talking about very small changes in our very local environment that has a much wider impact onto our whole ecosystem. It's, you know, you think about it as a very, you know, your little problem at your little yard, but by each of us doing our own bit, and we, you know, the steps we've talked about are all very simple and don't take a lot of time and effort to put in place. If we can all do a few little bits, the knock-on effect for our sort of national herd is huge.
You're completely right, Rachel. And, you know, I get so frustrated when people talk about sustainability and the environment being expensive, unworkable, blah, blah, blah. I mean, Claire, you would definitely be in the know on this from a stats point of view, but I would have thought that if we're not routinely worming and we're just changing our habits, you'll probably save money. And you'll certainly save money if you can have your horses out for longer, that you're not necessarily having to spend as much money on purchasing extra feed. I mean, this is a key thing with pasture management in general, that the more that we can just take the free grass that nature is providing us, the cheaper the horse ownership can be. And I think that it's these small changes in our routines and having that awareness so that they just become very, very normal, you know, will save money, as well as having, exactly as you say, Rachel, a really huge impact on the environment. It really, really would. It's worth doing. You can consider yourself a poo hero if you just follow, you know, even some, if not all, of the tips that Claire has shared.
Yeah, fantastic. You're absolutely right, Ruth. And definitely there's a cost benefit to our testing, but it's not just the cost from a monetary perspective. You know, it's what we're saving in terms of our ability to keep horses into the future for resistance. So the ability to live in our world with our crystal clear waters and our environment, how we want it, to be able to appreciate that with the mosaic of different animals and plants we share that with, and not having that adverse impact. So the ripple effect is absolutely massive.
Absolutely. And there's one last point I'd like to touch on here. And this is sort of, I guess it is sort of connected, but we've talked obviously about the impacts of these drugs and what happens if you're putting them into your horse and then it's coming out the other end and into the environment. We also need to consider about how we're disposing of those drugs once we have put the syringe in the horse. You're left with a tube that could potentially still have some treatment in it, because obviously we're doing it by weight. You're not necessarily putting the whole tube down. How should we be using these drugs in a very careful, considered way that, and then disposing of them in a similar way?
Yeah, so we've talked about them in the big picture context, but just in our immediacy, they are very toxic and very poisonous, and particularly to dogs. So any collie or collie cross type, very susceptible to our ivermectin and moxidectin drugs in terms of taking too much of that. So definitely if you're going to give a treatment, give it on a hard surface like concrete or tarmac, so that you can clean any spit out. You know, some of them do have a little objection to that, and it doesn't maybe all make it into the horse, so you can clean that up. It's not getting washed into waterways. It's meaning that it's not going to be, you know, how dogs are interested on yards, aren't they? And they're often, wormers are quite palatable to dogs, especially if you give them in a feed. So for the horse, so just making sure that they're not having access to any of that, putting that straight into a bin, any syringes or tubes. And then we've also got to think then about dogs and their delightful habit of eating dung. And if you've got these metabolites again being passed out, just having an awareness to minimize that. And because it would just be such an awful thing, wouldn't it? If our canine friends were impacted by that particular consequence of having to worm our horses. So it's being aware of that, really, and helping to protect them and putting the wormers straight into the bin and disposing of them carefully rather than having them hanging around.
And just thinking about what Claire's saying there, it just brings us full circle back to what we talked about at the beginning. You know, Claire's using some really strong words there in terms of how powerful these drugs are, and we don't want them near our dogs. But if we don't want them near our dogs and we find them to be very, very powerful, let's not let them lie around in our wild spaces and get into our waterway, because it's exactly the same. And although you might not have the same love and affection for a duck or an otter living in your nearby stream as you do for your own dog, it is fundamentally the same thing.
Absolutely. And I think as well as that communication element as well. So if you are on the yard and you are treating your horse and you know that there are dogs roaming around, people bringing their dogs to the yard, making sure that everyone else is aware that you've used the drugs, the horse has been wormed, so that those owners then need to be very careful if they're bringing their dogs onto the yard, that poo could be containing these chemicals, and that, as you say, that spots and things on the floor are carefully cleaned up and not licking and generally making a nuisance of themselves, because we love our horses, we love our canine friends as well. So I think we've talked about a lot today and a lot of very powerful stuff we've sort of discussed there, which is good. I found it really, really interesting. As we come to the end, are there any points that either of you would like to raise, maybe that we've missed or you feel just needs to sort of be hammered home as that final takeaway message for our listeners? This is your moment in the spotlight.
I think mine would just be about this strategic thinking. So if we can just do this carefully, I think small steps will pay these huge dividends in our time, our horses' health, the environment in the long run. And it's just an investment worth making is really would be my take home message.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's about really thinking about what we're doing. Sometimes we're so disconnected, you know, you get something in a tube, you stick it in your horse, you know, it's the right thing for the horse, it's done, end of. Really thinking about what's actually in this. What does it mean to be a toxin? What does it mean to actually put toxins into our environment? And the fact that we really do need to care about that, that we need to make this make sense. And we need to, whether you're a visual person or whatever, we need to help one another to really start to understand that toxins in our environment are what's causing our profusion of ill health, cancers, infertility, growth issues, the real epidemics that we're having in our society. And it comes down to the profusion of toxins that we have in our day-to-day life. And so I just think so much wonderful work has been done, particularly through the veterinary community, of educating everyone on not just liberally using these things. And I think it's about bring that point home to the finish line of this really matters, because we want to be healthy as human beings, and we can't be healthy if we keep polluting the planet the way we are.
Exactly. Very well put. And one final point, if anyone listening wants to find out a bit more about what we've discussed today, or just sort of generally about what steps they can take on their yard to minimize the impact of using these drugs, have you got any suggestions for them?
Yeah, absolutely. The Canter guidelines, which you'll have talked a lot about, I think, in the previous podcast, there's a whole chapter dedicated to minimizing the impact in the environment of anthelmintics. And we've got lots of resources on our website as well to help horse owners. So it's there if you look for it. And if anyone needs any particular guidance or whatever, just get in touch, please.
I think my guidance would literally be to say we're really, really lucky in our industry to have Claire and her team and the organisation. I have no commercial affiliation to Claire whatsoever, but I'm so impressed by the depth of knowledge and care, and we're really lucky to have that as a resource. So I would say, if you don't know, they walk the walk in terms of everything from just not just the actual worming options, but, you know, thinking about plastics in their tubs and all those kind of things. So use the resources that we have available. The information's there. I would say go and check out their resources.
Oh, thanks, Ruth. Yeah, it's a big one of our values. And as you say, we walk the talk. Talk the walk. Don't know which way that round that one goes.
Do all the good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, both of you. It's been a really interesting chat. And I hope you've enjoyed sharing your wisdom with us. If anyone listening at home, I would recommend that you check out the other two podcasts we've put out this week. You will find them wherever it is that you found this one, wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And we've also been sharing some resources on our social media as well. So do check those out. Thank you very much to everyone who's engaged with Worming Week. Thank you very much to Claire and to Ruth. I hope you have enjoyed spending this time with us today.
Always.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks everyone.
And of course, the one parting piece of advice that we have had throughout this week is to make sure that you're in communication with your vet or your prescriber, whoever it is, and making sure that you are using that guidance to make sure that you come up with a testing plan and, if needed, a treatment plan that suits your individual horse and your individual set of circumstances. So on that note, I will sign off now. So thank you very much for listening, everyone, and we hope you'll join us again soon.